You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Cynthia Farquhar and Michaela Selway coming through to Kōrero about their new book, Against the Odds, New Zealand's First Women's First Women Doctors. Good morning to both of you. How are you doing?
Great, thank you.
Good morning. Great, thanks.
Nice. Michaela, you're coming to us live from Boston, which is awesome. Cindy, whereabouts are you coming from?
From Auckland. I'm at the university today.
Nice. And how are things up in Auckland?
It's a bit wet.
Same down here. It's not very nice. What's the weather like in Boston, Michaela?
It's like 25 degrees. Very
summer,
warm.
Right?
It's summer here. So it feels like I've gone from wet, rainy Auckland to very warm summer here. It's quite nice.
That's awesome. Now, this book here, Against the Odds, it couldn't have come out at a better time. You know, the domestic situation, we have the pay equity scheme kind of defaulting and going on the back burner. And there's also, you know, abortion rights in the United States are backsliding. It feels like an important time to discuss wahine heroes. This book is full of them. Who are some of your wahine heroes from Against the Odds?
Oh, thanks. Thanks for asking. I've got a whole list, of course. So going through the decades that the book covers. I mean, I'm really impressed with the story of Dr. Doris Gordon, who came from Stratford. She was a GP there, and graduated in 1915. And through the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, she campaigned for better maternity services in New Zealand. And you know, in those days, communication wasn't easy, but she managed to inspire a generation of women, really, around the country to fundraise. And they managed to raise funds for improving maternity services in Dunedin, getting a professor of obstetrics there in Dunedin, and then they moved north and established a fund to establish the National Women's Hospital in Auckland, and also a professor of obstetrics and gynecology. And actually, I'm the fourth person in that professorial role, so that's rather lovely. But imagine doing that when transport wasn't that easy, and you know, it was all letters, and holding meetings must have been really difficult. And she, I mean, she's really inspiring campaigner. You know, got down to Wellington and really shook things up. And I think we can say that she made a big difference to our maternity services. I'll give Michaela a chance now. I've got a couple more I'd like to talk about, but over to you.
Yeah, no, there's so many, and I mean, it's so hard trying to pick one out. There's over 400 women that graduated from our time period that we were looking at, but one group I guess I could talk about that really stood out to me in the book were the refugees and the academics. I guess because I'm coming from a more academic standpoint, I'm currently doing my PhD in history, and so these women that really fought for their rights to get lectureships and professorships in the university. Barbara Heslop was the first professor and the only one in our time period to actually get a professorship and to really fight for that. And then you get other women who, Hendrika Wellmanning, for example, she was a refugee that came as a result of World War II, and she felt like she couldn't really fight for her rights, more fight for what she deserved, because she ended up running a research clinic and being integral to the running of it, but she wasn't the face of it, so she didn't get all the credit for it. But she did all of this while doing her MD, for example, and raising children. And these, I could name woman after woman, but all of them have achieved so much. It's been an honor, really, to learn about them.
That is one of the common themes, I think, throughout this book, is that a lot of these women, of course, are doing incredible things in the classroom, but they're also expected to do all this home labor, which is so unfair.
Yeah.
It's bullshit.
Yeah.
very, very challenging, and it's great to see these women be honoured. I was really touched by the opener, Cindy, in which you write about the treatment of your respective parents passing in the media. Both were doctors, but only your father received a full-page feature in the Waikato Times when he passed, and you had to write your mother's feature about all the work that she did because she was an amazing, incredible person. What did that experience tell you about how women in medicine are treated in today's time?
Well, of course, it is different today. And I'm, although I could, tell you a few stories, nothing compared to what the earlier generations went through. It was very uneven. Mm-hmm. And, this whole societal expectation that you would, that you were wasting a place in medical school, that you probably wouldn't work, that you wouldn't be a productive member of the profession. So that was very prevalent, and the circumstances were so different. There was, there was so little organised childcare. Now there's this just great options for people to return to work. And also our job, the jobs that you had as junior doctors and senior doctors back in the day, they were really tough call rosters and making home life extremely difficult. And there was very little opportunity for job sharing while you were training. So, you do your 6 years of medical education, then there's another several years for specialty training and generally in hospitals. And those were really counterproductive for very difficult for women to go through those training programs unless they had some extraordinary support. So, I think these days I'm happy to report that it is much better, but we do still come across, some examples where, quite often you get mixed up for being a nurse, which is fine, but that's not who you are. You could be doing the funny stories that women doctors share. You might be doing a ward round, and there might be a male doctor on the ward round, a junior doctor, and a patient sometimes will ask the only male in the room, what would you do if they're trying to make up their mind about some options they've got to decide about, which always makes us laugh. And then there's often assumptions made, about women doctors that, you're probably not going to train in neurosurgery or, some real hard clinical choices like being a brain surgeon or a cardiac surgeon, something like that. Oh, women wouldn't do that. They do. They have, and they are doing it. So it's great to see. But when I was coming through that, there were lots of assumptions made about where you might end up.
Mm-hmm. So Cindy, you come from a very medical background, and Michaela, you come from a very history background. Obviously, this book is the two of those put together. What were the roles that you kind of, or how did you create this book together? Did you assign roles to each other?
Michaela.
Yeah, no. So I guess we are coming from a long project. The project Early Medical Women of New Zealand has been running since 2016. And the purpose of that project was to record oral histories, hear these stories of the women that are still alive or their families, memories of their mother or their grandmother, and turn it into a biography and put it onto the website. Whereas when we got the opportunity to do the book, we felt it was really important to shift gears a little bit because those biographies are accessible on the website, but we wanted to put these women's experiences in their historical context because what we'd found throughout the years is that so many of these women's abilities to study certain tracks or go overseas, professions that they could go into, were all shaped by societal events that were happening, such as the war or such as refugees coming in or the ability to have family planning even affected if they could stay in university or not when they got married or had children. And so we felt it was really important when doing a book having these biographies, of course, and featuring these women, but placing them in their context so that we can better understand the pressures that they were really facing. So I think that's where the expertise actually worked really well together, is I could kind of bring the historical context side of it. But Cindy's wealth of medical knowledge is just incredible. And there were so many areas that I didn't understand certain ideas, or even some of the women. Cindy can probably talk about, there seems to be this chain of women doctors, where there was a woman who inspired somebody else. And Cindy's talked about being mentored by some of the women in the book. And it's just incredible to have that wealth of knowledge as well.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome, man. I want to touch on, I guess, the fact that the University of Otago was the first university in the country to admit women, which is... You know, it's a real strong point, but it's also sad that not all the universities did immediately. A reason why this was the case is due to the lobbying of educationalist Learmonth Dalrymple, which is a beautiful name. What did that example of University of Otago being the first place to admit women, you know, what did that set for the rest of the medical schools around the country? Did that pressure them to do the same, or were we really the old one out?
Well, of course, the University of Otago was the first university in the country and the first medical school. So I think we only have two medical schools at the moment, but all of the medical schools have training throughout the country. So there's, you know, the northern part of the North Island is generally speaking, the Auckland training centres, and all the rest, Wellington, Christchurch and Otago, Dunedin, as well as lots of outposts. So medical schools are outside of the universities, really. They're in the clinical areas all over the place. So coming back to your question, what did it mean? I mean, I think it's... I was, when I realised that Dunedin and Otago University, you know, they really did lead that change to women's education. There's a story, it's not a story, it happened in Edinburgh, that women were actually training but not being allowed to complete their training in medicine, but they weren't allowed to actually be awarded their degrees. This is about mid-1870s, and they stormed the Citadel where the university were meeting, seven women, to camp, you know, in a fairly strident way, barged in, I think, and you know, to insist that they would be allowed to be awarded their degrees. It's quite amazing, but it went on for another... Not in Edinburgh so much, but in other parts of the UK, women were completing their PhDs but not being awarded their PhDs. So they'd done all the research. And that, I think, went up until the 1920s. So it wasn't uncommon that there was just like, why would you award them a degree? What are they going to do with it? You know, they were just, that was the way people were thinking at the time. So I think Otago, yeah, real leader in that regard. And although we could say, Michaela, we could tell the story of Mary Tracy. You might tell that story.
Yeah, so I guess putting it in a bit of the history of Otago Medical School, because it was founded after all of the campaigning that had happened in the UK, and our universities are really modelled on the British system. Women had already been given access in the UK by the time Otago Medical School opened. So if you actually read through the lore, I guess, of the medical school, they were never banned. It was more that New Zealand society didn't really feel like women's place was to be able to work, it was to be in the home. And so what we really find at the beginning is this tension between, yes, they're accepted, but are they accepted? And the first woman to actually apply to the medical school did high enough in her grades to get a scholarship, which is incredible at that time. She beat out a number of other candidates. It's all posted in the newspaper. But because she was a woman, she didn't gain the support of the medical board, so didn't actually get acceptance at the time. And then a few years later, I think about 5 years later, we have our first medical graduate applying to medical school. That's Emily Cederberg. And she is also only tentatively accepted. And she was accepted, but there was a really big debate on whether women should be separated from the men, especially because they considered some topics not suitable for women to learn about, such as reproductive organs, for example. And they were worried about the influence of a woman sitting in the classroom with the men. And so, yes, Otago was progressive, I guess you could say, in accepting women, but it was a very reluctant progressiveness, I guess you could say. And yeah. I think even later, Truby King said, yeah, it's great that we have women in the medical school, but should they really work? So, yeah, I wouldn't totally post it as something that was fully progressive.
Oh, no, for sure. I mean, I think I read a story in the book about a professor not wanting to teach women. You know, there's all sorts of examples like that. I want to touch on, I guess, a little bit more of a modern time, the interwar period. I see that as between World War I and World War II, of course. I see that as a very fascinating time because technologically and economically, the country was really transforming, but it was still progressing very slow socially as New Zealand still had this idea of being a better Britain, which, if I'm not mistaken, kind of reinforced, you know, those strict gender binary roles. How did this period impact women going into medicine, especially with regard to influenza, because that was such a real hell of a time?
Yeah, it's an interesting one because World War One, I think, was the first time that women really gained their acceptance. Men were overseas, and so they were almost considered necessary. And so you get this group of women feeling really privileged and happy to be able to study this, but then they end their degrees about the time that the return servicemen are coming, and they're like, cool, okay, so we've trained you, but there's actually no jobs for you. And it was really put into this priority of, well, the men have returned, and so, yeah, women just go back home. And so it's this really weird time period, and I think that's why in the book we put the two decades together, because even though it's two decades of time between the two world wars, a lot happens that women have this opportunity and to go and study, but not only to go study, but to work, because we find a lot of men coming back and not wanting to do certain jobs. And that's, I think, a big thing with the influenza, is that a lot of the men don't, obviously not all of the men, there are some men that do go on the front lines, but a lot of the men would like to have their cozy practice. And so we found a lot of the women that we were interviewing were writing biographies about were the ones that were going out to the front lines of the influenza, you could call it. But at the same time, facing these restrictions, despite all of the effort that they're putting in, and having, I think, a lot of progress made in entertainment and access to new types of fashion from overseas, and travel is even something that's growing during this period, but you still have this quite restrictive nature in the workplace, which is a weird tension that we tried to explore in the book. But, yeah, it was quite unfortunate.
That was a real fascinating period, eh? This book consists of, as we've talked about before, this book consists of dozens of profiles of women pioneers in medicine, as well as analysis of the time they operated in. One that I thought was really fascinating was Molly Smith, who was extremely poor. I mean, like, their clothes were made by their mum. And they went to Otago when she was 16 years old. So not only, actually, never mind. She was an incredibly bright person, and the detail on her and her career, along with the rest of the profiles, are quite immaculate. You know, what were some of the struggles that you encountered with doing a lot of the research?
Yeah, that's a many, many struggles. I mean, this is primarily an oral history project, and so we're trying to gain information from descendants, family members, the graduates if they're still alive, and in that case you're dealing with memory. And I guess one of the things that, coming from a trained historian's perspective, that not everyone in the wider public may be aware of, is that memory is very subjective and it's based on experience, and there really is no hard truth. And so it's been really hard trying to capture this woman's experience, which is her truth, at the same time as dealing with historical records that we might find in the newspapers or in diaries, journal entries, anything that we really can find to try and capture exactly what's going on. And that's when we have a really good opportunity, when we can have an interview, because a lot of these women, because of the nature of working in this period, chose not to have children or couldn't, I guess they talked about it as not having the time to meet someone and have a family when they're having to fight so hard for their rights in the workplace. Mm. And so when there is no family connection, we're kind of looking at a name on a piece of paper trying to trace breadcrumbs. And so we've been really fortunate to have a lot of online databases. A lot of stuff is being digitized in New Zealand at the moment. And so Papers Past, for example, has digitized newspapers, I think, all the way back to 1870 or something like that. And so there you can have all of the graduation records, all of the class lists, scholarships, all that kind of stuff. That's where we've really had to get the basic information from and kind of build as much of a picture from there as possible. But to anyone who reads the book or website, you'll see we're very honest about sometimes we just don't know something. And so we just say very little is known about their time in school, or very little is known about their early life, because if it's not written down or published and there's no one we can speak to, then it's kind of difficult to fill in those gaps, I guess.
Mm. I think we're running out of time here on the program. I want to thank you both for coming on. Mm. And if you have any final words, now is the time.
Oh, well, if anyone wants to get in touch with us, if any of the doctors in that period up to graduated up to 1967, please get in touch with me at the University of Auckland, because we'd love to interview you. We know that there are more people out there who haven't had their biographies written. So thank you very much for having us, and get in touch.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. And Michaela.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, no, it's just, I guess it's been an honour to write this book, but there are so many more women out there. So it'd be great to hear from anyone, and thank you as well for letting us talk about this. It's such an incredible project, and there's been a lot of books written about the University of Otago, but this is the first one about the woman in the medical school. So we really hope that we've honoured them, and that everyone who picks up a copy of the book is inspired.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I think you certainly have on all of them. And you can find this book at Massey University Press, as well as aotearoabooks.co.nz, as well as Mighty Ape. Thank you for coming on the program. I wish you all a beautiful rest of your day, and hopefully winter doesn't affect you too much. I know that you'll be affected by winter, Sydney. Michaela, enjoy summer.
Will do. Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. All right. Thank you very much. Naomi. All right, folks, that was Cindy Farquhar and Michaela Selway. We're talking to them about their new book, Against the Odds, New Zealand's First Woman Doctors. A really, really awesome read. Coming up.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcasts.